I'm going to say this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida. And this evening I've got my co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest this evening is Dr. Nick Begich. And he's the eldest son of the late U.S. Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich, Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He is well known in Alaska for his own political activities and was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Nick Begich has received a Doctor of Medicine, Medicina Alternativa, honoris causa, boy, those are words I've not tried to pronounce before, for independent work in health and political science from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines, Colombo, Sri Lanka, in November 1994. And he co-authored with Gene Manning the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology. Begich has also authored Earth Rising, The Revolution Toward a Thousand Years of Peace, and his latest book on Earth Rising to the Betrayal of Science, Society and the Soul, both with the late James Roderick. His latest work is Controlling the Human Society and Soul, Human Mind, the Technologies of Political Control or Tools for Peak Performance, and has published articles in Science, Politics, and Education, and as well is a well-known lecturer, having presented throughout the United States and in 19 countries. And he's been a featured guest on thousands of radio broadcasts, reporting on his research activities, including new technologies, health, and earth science-related issues, and has also appeared on dozens of television documentaries and other programs throughout the world, including the BBC TV, CBC TV, Telemundo, and others. And he's served as an expert witness and speaker before the European Parliament and has spoken on various issues for groups representing citizens concerned, statesmen and elected officials, scientists, and others. Is a publisher and co-author of Earth Pulse Press and has served as tribal administrator, village planner for the Chickaloon Village Council, a federally recognized American Indian tribe of the Athabascan Indian Nation for 5 years, and served 4 years as the executive director of the Lay Institute of Technology, Incorporated, a Texas nonprofit corporation, and currently consults for tribal organizations, private corporations, and others in a number of research areas. So, welcome, Dr. Begich.
Well, thanks for having me. Sorry about the long bio. You could have shortened that up a bit.
I know, I was trying to find a shorter one, but wasn't successful. Dr. Carlson.
Well, if I could just add to that bio, just one more thing. Dr. Begich also maintains a website called earthpulse.com. I was on it the other day, and he features a number of very interesting DVDs. Which I have not yet seen, but I intend to order and take a look at on the issues of HARP and mind control and things like that. So maybe we could start, Nick, with that topic, HARP, and as it pertains to geoengineering. You have been you've written the book Angels Don't Play This HARP with Gene Manning. So this is something I think most Americans don't know anything about. So maybe we could just get you to tell us what it is and what it does.
Sure. HARP is the High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Project based here in Alaska, and it's currently run by, operated by DARPA, which is does mainly defense research, and it's just for the various branches of the military. It has a number of uses, primarily communications and surveillance-based technology, but it has some unusual capacities in terms of what it can do. It is the largest radio frequency transmitter of this design ever built, and it actually focuses radio frequency energy into a relatively small area, and then utilizing that energy manipulates various features of our environment, particularly the ionosphere, which is associated with the character and quality of terrestrial communications, wireless communications, obviously. And the nature of the ionosphere is such that when it becomes disturbed by solar events, as an example, you get disturbances in communications across the planet. You can even get at real high energy levels interference with the power grid. What HARP was intended to do initially was learn a little bit more about the character of the ionosphere and then see if we could manipulate it to our advantage during periods of disruption, be able to stabilize it, or conversely, in situations where you'd want to disturb communications, be able to perturb it in such a way as to be able to accomplish that. Those were kind of the early discussions about what HARP could do. Ben Eastland, the inventor, Dr. Eastland, had a number of other ideas that he continued to develop up until his death in 2007. And some of those started to get into the idea of weather modification on a much more aggressive level than what he thought was originally possible with systems like HARP.
Yeah, and we're actually talking about technologies that can be used not only for weather modification but also for weather warfare, including creating artificially creating droughts, artificially creating drugs, floods, steering hurricanes, and even inducing artificial earthquakes. I think the thing that is difficult for most people to get their minds around is that we're dealing with electromagnetic radiation. We're dealing with things that we can't see. Radio waves, for instance, we all, you know, tune in our radios, but we really, most of us don't understand what radio waves are, and that they are just part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which goes from very, very tiny wavelengths of energy, including X-rays and gamma rays, et cetera, up to very, very long wavelengths of energy. Again, we can't see it, but these things all can be manipulated for various purposes, positive and negative. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, part of that is just recognizing that there are certain you could almost draw an analogy, like we're on radio today. People dial through the radio. They get a harmony, a resonance between the transmitter and the receiver, and they get a nice clear signal when they hit the station. In between, it's basically static. And you can look at that and sort of overlay that radio frequency energy in that broader spectrum beyond what is on broadcast radio. And then you start to look at what other kinds of resonance effects can you create, harmonies can you create. And this is where you start to look at physiological effects in terms of living organisms, and you also look at sort of the mechanical effects of the planet. And, you know, often, for instance, with earthquakes, low-frequency wavelengths are often associated with precursors to earthquake activity, as an example. Other activity, even weather activity associated with certain energetic fields. In fact, Eastland took it a little bit further, and he believed that by manipulating gravitational fields in a very specific way, in gravity waves, he was thinking of being able to manipulate these in a very dramatic way using HARP. And his last paper that he did for the University of Pennsylvania on this subject, he determined that you could literally manipulate these wavelengths in such a way as to affect weather systems with 1,600 times less power than when he originally invented HARP. In other words, he figured out a different mechanism using a different wavelength to affect sort of the underlying mechanisms of what he believed drives or would drive major weather shifts or weather patterns. But it's that kind of science, that idea of sort of tuning in to the planet in just such a way with just the right amount of energy to trigger energy that otherwise is naturally stored and released within the planet, whether it be in the ionosphere or whether it be in fault zones within the planet itself. In fact, there was an idea that was kicked around And it was during the Clinton administration, and it came out of a DOD news briefing back in April of 97, and it was William Cohen, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, and he made the following quote, and it says, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. Now, if you stop and think about that, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, climate change, all triggered by what Cohen said, electromagnetic waves. Now, that's just not random, like the static between the stations. This is very precise energy designed to do a very specific thing, to couple with the Earth and then to trigger events within the Earth. And that's essentially what this science is about, and HARP happens to be the largest energy transmitter ever designed of its type to create not just these effects, but many other effects as well.
Well, if I could jump in, Nick, with another quote that's perhaps fairly well known, at least amongst the people that are looking into this. Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who wrote a book in the 1970s, I believe 1972, wrote a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era.
Right.
And by the way, Brzezinski is one of the main men behind our present president, Barack Obama, in terms of advising capacity. He stated back in 72, "Technologies will make available to the leaders of the major nations techniques for conducting secret warfare of which only a bare minimum of the security forces need be appraised. Technology of weather modification could be used to produce prolonged periods of drought or storm, uses of weather and other weapons for mind control." So obviously, even back in 72, it was understood that this is where this was going to be a big thing in the coming decades.
Right. In fact, that quote I used in a couple of different publications, the HARP book, we used that quote. And actually, there's a predecessor quote that goes back to 1969 to J.F. Gordon MacDonald. And Brzezinski quotes him. And MacDonald was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson. And he was also a full professor of geophysics at UCLA. And one of the things that he had suggested and Brzezinski picked up on was if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, that we could create a signal that would affect the behavior of people over a huge geographic area. And that showed up in a book called Unless Peace Comes, published in 1969. And, you know, that whole idea, that concept that then Brzezinski played on in 72 was advanced even further if you look from 72 to the present. The kinds of technologies, the kinds of systems that would be necessary would be these large broadcast systems that could concentrate energy and then utilize the natural energy systems of the planet to sort of carry that signal. And in fact, that's what happens with HARP, not just for affecting human behavior and biological systems, but just using the magnetic field lines that surround the Earth as even waveguides for other weapons applications are part of the HARP scenario. So a very different step. I mean, where we used to think of weapons as bombs and bullets, things that blew up and tore tissue, now we're looking at systems that are designed specifically to interact with very large natural systems, the energetic systems of the planet itself. And that's where we get very concerned, and others have expressed concern, you know, over the years as we've continued to advance public awareness on this particular project.
And of course, you mentioned. Sorry, go ahead, Melody.
When you're talking about that affecting the behavior of humans with the with this particular weapon, would it if there was high concentrations of metals that were in being dispersed within the atmosphere, would that have a contributing factor to this?
Not necessarily. In fact, there's a lot of discussion about that I've seen on the Internet. It's totally unnecessary to create an effect, number one. The idea of dispositing aluminum or barium, which is often what's associated with those discussions, into the atmosphere has been cited, but the sampling is really poor. I mean, firstly, aluminum in the environment is pretty common. In fact, in the places where this has been reported, there's a couple of things that should be noted. There was a doctoral dissertation done a number of years ago. It later became a book called The Secret Lives of Dust. It was written by Hannah Holmes. And what she determined was there are two major dust flows, one coming from the North Africa and the Sahara region. And the way they discovered this was there was a bauxite, an aluminum deposit, discovered on one of the islands in the Bahamas, that under it was coral, which is an organic material, and above it then bauxite and then corals above that. And they're trying to figure out, how do you get a bauxite deposit, an aluminum deposit in the middle of this? And then if you look at the soils of the southeastern United States, they're an orange soil with a very high aluminum content. That soil, people believe, and scientists now believe, is probably largely deposited from dust from the Sahara. Likewise, on the west coast from California all the way up to the southern portions of Alaska, you have dust coming in from Southeast Asia now carrying every kind of heavy metal and toxin you can imagine coming out of Asia into the west coast of the United States. So people who are sampling are finding samples and finding the occurrence of aluminum and other processed metals, but these are now so widely dispersed in our environment. Unless you're sampling at the point of discharge, where these particulate materials are being discharged from an aircraft or something like this, you really can't make a clear conclusion from our perspective. And the other one is barium.
If I could just interject here, I think what Melody's referring to is the whole discussion about chemtrails and what Rosalind Peterson calls persistent contrails. And there's absolutely no question that method spraying campaigns have been going on for 20 years without the public's knowledge or consent. In fact, in Crestone, Colorado on Monday morning, which was a clear morning, I counted about 32 different trails, in the sky. And so there is, I think, a real legitimate connection there between weather modification, because one of the things that happens is you create artificial high-level clouds, cirrus clouds, which dims the amount of incoming solar radiation, actually reduces it, so it becomes a problem for plants and animals and people.
Sure.
So it's a gigantic issue in and of itself. And then the question I think Melody was alluding to is it being used in a concert combination with HAARP? And there are many people who say that yes, if you zap the suspended aluminum and metals with wavelengths of electromagnetic energy, you can effectively warm that part of the sky and keep the water vapor from condensing. And by warming the atmosphere, you could therefore induce drought. And it seems to me that this can be proven experimentally anywhere. In a little test tube almost, a little chamber. So it does seem like they can be working together. But I have to also say that as a soil scientist, aluminum is very common constituent of the earth. It's, I think it's like third or fourth most common element in the earth. And aluminum oxides and hydroxides and iron oxides and hydroxides build up due to chemical weathering in soils over time, especially in warm climates such as you have in the southeast. So if you've got a high aluminum content in the soil in, say, Georgia or Brazil or something like that, it's due to the fact that that soil has been weathering over hundreds of thousands, sometimes even millions of years, and the chemical weathering processes leave aluminum and iron as residual components of the soil. So no doubt there's dust that gets around the world, but soils are aluminum and iron factories as well as clay. They produce that stuff over time by chemical weathering.
Now, one thing I'll say, too, about the this whole chemtrails issue is relative to creation of cirrus clouds. This is something that was first noted back in the 1980s, and there was research on that could not be confirmed, take it from theory to fact, until actually 9/11, when they shut down air traffic throughout the United States, and atmospheric scientists were then able to prove their models that actually it was, it's basically aircraft that is contributing significantly more than they ever imagined, sort of downwind in the formation of cirrus clouds. Now, when you look at air traffic and international freight traffic, and if you were to graph that on a scale, you would see this very sharp rise coming out of the 1970s forward, where we were increasing air traffic at unprecedented levels to the point where to try and compare atmospheric conditions then to now, you really have to consider the fact that we are contributing to weather, not just by what people are considering greenhouse gases, but just by the formation of clouds with the incredible amount of air traffic. The other thing we've done is change the formulations of some of our jet fuels that don't allow for as clean of a burn as we may have once gotten. And that has some contributing factors. There are also new, there's actually new jet fuels being formulated that are partially biofuels that are a bit different in chemistry. And then you have atmospheric conditions changing generally. I mean, here in Alaska, I live next to an Air Force base. I grew up next to it. And seeing jet trails in our atmosphere, particularly in subarctic type of conditions, is pretty common. But as temperature situations change across the planet, I think people are observing more for a variety of reasons. One is there's more traffic, and secondly, the recognition that that these contrails do contribute to cloud formation. I think that's very valid. The idea of spraying something to damage the public, there have been instances that have been proven in the literature that have been acknowledged by our government of participating in those kinds of activities. So none of that particularly surprises me. If you have metals present, can you take advantage of those with systems like HARP? And the answer is yes. In fact, if you have any chemical constituent that you can resonate a signal off of, you can create a very toxic environment that is unexplainable. I'll give you a good example. Robert Becker used this actually in one of his publications years ago, and what he said was essentially that, you know, all of us, if we're healthy, have a certain amount of iodine within our body. And iodine, when it gets excessive, can make us very sick, can even kill us. But if you do the normal test, check the thyroid, look at iodine levels, you'll get some conclusions. And then if you were to resonate a signal, send a signal in that was at the same resonant frequency of iodine, the body, the human body, would begin to react. If it had just gotten a massive dosage of iodine, it'll exhibit all of the various symptoms of iodine poisoning, yet when they check iodine levels, everything appears normal. This can easily be done with any electromagnetic system if you can figure out how to carry a signal on it of the right frequency and the right range to trigger these kinds of events. Well, every chemical constituent, every element has a unique frequency associated with it, so that if you can create a signal that harmonizes with that signal, you can create effects. So if you were in a battlefield, as an example, and you were to dump a specific chemical into that battlefield that affected all of your adversaries and you kept your troops away from it, you could then send a signal in, and only those exposed to that chemical or that metal or that constituent would be affected by the broadcast signal. So, you know, when you think about very precise and precision kind of an attack on a population, you could see how this could be delivered, and yet you'd have no viable explanation of what the heck happened. And the same with weather modification. It's why during Cheney's time and Rumsfeld's time recently at the White House, they wanted to abandon weather modification treaties we had signed in the 70s. And their rationale was the technology is too good. You know, we can raise a totally clandestine war, and nobody would even know they were in a war. You know, they just wouldn't have the ability to grow food, either from flood or from drought. That's the kind of warfare scenarios that are being anticipated and probably being played out today. Problem is there's no ability to model the entire Earth system and understand the consequences of each of these actions.
Dr. Begich, now that same premise would be what homeopathy is based on, correct?
It's a very similar idea. You know, in fact, the idea of using very small amounts of material and getting it into the body where the body can then react with it, I suppose that's sort of the light version. You know, man's version is, now we know what we can do with a feather. Let's get a sledgehammer and see what happens. and I think that's where we've kind of gone awry, because we're looking at very big systems today that are changing the face of warfare. In fact, they call it now and have for the last couple of decades, a revolution in military affairs, that they equate to the same kind of changes that took place when atomic weapons were introduced in the last century or gunpowder in the centuries before. The change of using energy as a basis of weapon systems in a much different way, not in the sense of burning and tearing tissue, but degrading performance of humans, which is really the objective of war, is to degrade the performance of your adversary so they cannot wage war. In a modern context, the idea of rebuilding nations has become pretty burdensome. We can look at Iraq and Iran and sort of what's happening in that part of the world in terms of shutting down economies and then what it takes to restart them. You know, on one side, we've tried to shut Iran down unsuccessfully. Iraq, we have totally obliterated, and yet really haven't solved anything. And so the idea of a lot of these systems is, well, how can we engage in control of our adversaries without necessarily having all of the political consequences that are associated with it? And this is one of them, the ability to raise warfare models in a manner that doesn't alert the public, doesn't alert your adversary, and results in the outcomes you're looking for. And ultimately, it's the outcomes that drive the policy decisions.
Well, do you find that?
Just to give a background here, you know, when you talk about Bernard Eastland, the guy who came up with some patents that are being used at HAARP, he acknowledged that a lot of his ideas came from the Serbian genius Nikola Tesla, who worked in the last part of the 19th century, and is the guy who invented alternating current and the radio, and understood electromagnetic radiation better than anybody did at that time. And he has said that he invented a thing called the death ray. He also invented wireless, where he thought he could provide energy for the whole world, you know, transmitted across the atmosphere rather than through wires. And he also stated that if he interfered the right frequencies, that he would have the power to split the Earth in two.
Now, right.
We're dealing with some very, very powerful technologies here that were not used in this country, because in 1942 he died, I think, the night before he was supposedly going to meet with our President Roosevelt, and who knows if it was a peaceful death, natural or not. But anyway, most of his materials, including many of his, a lot of his research and patents, were sequestered and taken off by the military at that time. Then we don't see the military talking about this, but we do see the Soviet Union developing this, unbeknownst to most Americans. And there's a very fascinating interview by Tom Bearden, Colonel Tom Bearden, in 1984, called Soviet Weather Control Over the United States. And
right.
He talks about their Woodpecker signal and how they were actually able to steer the jet stream, create drought, create floods.
Right.
So this thing has a long history that most people don't know about.
That's
and
exactly.
I would argue also that the Star Wars research that was heavily subsidized by the U.S. government had a lot to do with bringing this technology into our own military capabilities. So I'm just trying to set the stage that this is not something that is new. This is something that's been around, and it has enormous power, more power than atom nuclear bombs.
Right. In fact, we had over 300 source documents in the book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, on this subject, and we trace that history going back many, many decades up to the present time. And I knew Bernard Eastland very well, and we'd become good friends over the course of the controversy. And Ben's attitude was much different than many that I had run into, because we were considerate of the fact that as a research scientist, everybody is sort of narrowed into their own sort of bandwidth. And so there's not a whole lot of generalists, and there's not a lot of overlap within the disciplines. And Eastland, instead of feeling and, you know, getting incensed by the fact that we were challenging his work in terms of what the outcomes would be, instead, he looked at what we were doing. He reached out to us as we had to him, And we maintained a dialogue with Dr. Eastland from 1994 all the way to his death in 2007. And I had the opportunity to invite him as my guest when I was working with the Lay Institute to a closed conference on the mind effects issue in just a few months before he had passed away. And we'd brought together a group of specialists, you know, on this subject. And one of the big revelations that came out of that discussion with Dr. Eastland, he had made a presentation, you know, on HARP, on sort of the good side and the bad side of the technology. And the big conclusion is, you know, you can't know everything and you need to remain open. And what Dr. Eastland started doing in his published work is encouraging his colleagues to not get so defensive when they're challenged by others, but to actually listen to those challenges and consider them in light of the fact that not everybody knows everything, and you need to take into consideration full effects. And so as he approached the science, he became somewhat concerned. He had a great relationship with DARPA, I can tell you, all the way to the very top. But in some areas, he felt that the military was not the best place to experiment. And weather modification, particularly on the systems he was developing, because his view of that was, if we allow this to be done in a clandestine way, the risks are just too great. It needs to be done, if done ever at all, in the open light of day with a multidisciplinary approach to it to avoid the kinds of risks that otherwise are associated with this kind of work. And the military is not the place to advance this kind of research, only in the fact that the ionosphere or any other constituent of our environment that we all rely on, no military, ours or anyone else's, should be allowed to experiment there and place all of us at a level of risk.
Yeah, and we should mention that, of course, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Navy, and Raytheon corporations are really, and the Pentagon in general, are amongst the principal sponsors of the HARP facility in Gulkona, Alaska. And that even though HARP is the most powerful of these ionospheric heaters, there are some, 20 others around the world?
Right, you have them.
That can do similar kinds of things.
Yeah, they have them in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, across northern Canada, across Europe. The Chinese have one in Antarctica. The Russians have 5 old transmitters and maybe some new ones. This is not unique to the United States. Many are experimenting in this area, and it's becoming increasingly so. Now, we started reporting on this now 15 years ago, and I can tell you over 15 years, none of our positions have changed relative to this technology. And over time, we've been proven correct. You know, we've seen the European Parliament act on this technology as a result of our efforts there. The Russian Duma, because of presentations and material that they had on the same technology, and others now have raised this issue literally around the world, because we're at a stage where these technologies, and this is just one example of them, they're going to determine to a large extent what this world looks like in the coming this coming century. And this generation is going to be the deciders of how technology is deployed and what kinds of risks we as a population are willing to accept.
Dr. Begich, is there a possibility with this would be, if used incorrectly, could be much more concern than even maybe atomic weapons?
I think so on some levels. You know, I mean, these are very powerful systems. They change the game substantially. They don't leave radioactive residue that sort of eliminates your ability to use the place you just conquered. So in that sense, it's a much cleaner technology and offers, again, offers military planners an opportunity to do some things that previously was just not possible.
I've done some
technology.
But let me just do a go ahead, Melody.
I've done some work with Captain Eric May, and he had done a major written a number of articles on observing something down in Texas City that was the equivalent of something you describe in some of your work about being able to create these huge explosions in the atmosphere. And he was claiming that that is what he observed at some point and made, you know, caused great, you know, great concern to him. So,
yeah, there's, you know, this whole area, as I said, is exploding in terms of technology and advances. The problem is there's not the kind of independent oversight. And it's not just our country, and I want to emphasize that. There are a lot of governments involved in this kind of research, all of them looking, for the same kind of answers. The idea of changing the game so dramatically is pretty profound. The idea of being able to manipulate energy to affect people in this way is something that just was not possible even 20, 30 years ago. What is now possible with this science is pretty far-reaching. In fact, there's a great article, if you look at a publication at the U.S. Army War College called Perimeters, there was an article called The Mind Has No Firewalls. And it's actually a reprint of a Russian military journal, and the whole discussion is about how to manipulate the behavior of people. And using energy as the source, what they say is that any energy source can be manipulated, whether it be a radio broadcast, TV, telephone, the power grid itself, the internet, anything that carries an electromagnetic signal, you can put on it a signal that the body or the mind will couple to, will recognize and react to. That's pretty profound. I mean, and any system can be used for this. In fact, I'll read you a direct quote out of that article because it really lays it out pretty clearly. And it says, and I quote, "A psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal," unquote. And again, a very small amount of energy. It's not the idea that you have to have this huge amount that burns tissue or tears tissue. Subtle amounts of energy drive our entire living organism, our body. Being able to interfere with that in a very subtle way by interfering literally with the circuitry of the body is what this is all about. And it has a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you can destroy a human being, but on the other hand, knowledge of this technology leads in another direction, and it leads towards the underlying mechanisms within our physical health. In other words, we can figure out ways to manipulate body chemistry by manipulating the energy within the body, and many have done this historically, shows up in literature here and there. What I can tell you is energy medicine as a concept coming out of sort of the weaponization of energy in this way is going to change health in terms of this country and the world. I think in the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to see a trend moving significantly away from the chemical models of health to electrochemical models, and from that on to what are more realistic models for human health, which is sort of the electromagnetic nature of the body that drives all of those chemical processes. And when we have a good understanding of that, then we will have a greater understanding of the damage we have done with the systems we've created. And that day is coming.
Does this tie into some of Royal
Rife? Yeah, if I could follow up on that, Melody.
Okay.
You asked about the explosion in Texas. One of the things that HARP can do is it can create a plume of electrically charged particles that can then be exploded when ignited by an electromagnetic pulse, which HARP can also. So HARP can create the plasma and then create the electromagnetic pulse that will cause the plasma or the electrically charged atoms or gases to explode. And
right.
this may be what he was talking about.
Could very well
would you,
be.
You
one of the other ideas within the patent, there was another idea where you could actually create a large weather balloon like object, fill it up with very fine magnesium particles, and then by hitting it with RF, radio frequency energy, you could cause all of it to discharge, to explode at once. And what it would create is a megaton yield without a radioactive fallout. And they were looking at that within the HARP patents. In fact,
wow.
You mentioned those. And they were looking at that to create EMPs, artificial EMPs, by using that kind of power, an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse that would interfere with, say, electronic devices, but doing it in a way where you wouldn't have the residual radioactive fallout that, you know, causes all the other problems. So that was, you know, that was one of the concepts that actually did show up within the literature. Doing it without a containment would be interesting, and maybe that's possible as well, and perhaps that's what the individual in Texas was referring to.
Now, I've got a quote here that you have in your own book, Angels Don't Play This Harp. It's from the New York Times, September 1940. And this is, of course, taking us back to Tesla. He's still alive at that point. Nikola Tesla, one of the truly great inventors who celebrated his 84th birthday on July 10th, tells the writer that he stands ready to divulge to the United States government the secret of his, quote, teleforce, with which, he said, airplane motors would be melted at a distance of 250 miles so that an invisible Chinese wall of defense could be built around the country. Now, that sounds, of course, a little bit like Star Wars. This, quote, teleforce, he said, is based upon an entirely new principle of physics that, quote, no one has ever dreamed about, unquote, different from the principle embodied in his inventions relating to the transmission of electrical power from a distance, from which he has received a number of basic patents. This new type of force, Mr. Tesla said, would operate through a beam 1/100,000,000th of a square centimeter in diameter and could be generated from a special plant that would cost no more than $2 million and would take only about 3 months to construct. The beam, he states, involves four new inventions, two of which already have been tested. One of these is a method and apparatus for producing rays and other manifestations of energy in free air, eliminating the necessity for a high vacuum. A second method is a method and process for producing, quote, very great electrical force. The third is a method for amplifying this force. And the fourth is a new method for producing, quote, a tremendous electrical repelling force, unquote. This would be the projector or gun of the system. The voltage for propelling the beam to its objective, according to the inventor, will attain a potential of 50 million volts. With this enormous voltage, he said, microscopic electrical particles of matter will be catapulted on their mission of defensive destruction. In other words, they'll fly apart. He has been working on this invention, he added, for many years and has recently made a number of improvements on it. Now, my question, Nick, is we've interviewed Dr. Judy Wood, who I think is probably the most qualified and most detailed researcher on what happened to the World Trade Center 9-1-1, and she believes that it was directed energy weapons that took the World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7 down, that basically what happens is molecular dissociation. The buildings did not collapse. They more or less were vaporized in air, and all that steel and concrete turned to fine particles of dust, as if the actual particles were repelling each other. I find her website, drjudywood.com, to be very, very convincing. And in fact, I have a website, www.911nwo.com. Which features her work and then moves it in other directions. But so my question to you, and I think one of the really interesting possibilities here is that we may have a connection between what happened on 9-1-1 and HAARP. Would you see the connection there?
I could not say. I think about that, and I've seen a lot of things trying to reference HAARP, and I just don't see it, and not the way HAARP is configured. You know, maybe some other technology that might be associated with the systems or the underlying systems, but HAARP is designed to work on a less precision basis. To create a fine precision output like that would be quite difficult. It just doesn't have as narrow of a range. You know, when you reflect it off of the ionosphere down to the Earth, to control the spread of that signal is pretty difficult in that regard.
Yeah, it may be that's you know, using similar forces in the sense of electromagnetic radiation, but what actually was used at 9-1-1 was different. For instance, Dr. Judy Wood has all these photos of these big smoky clouds coming up the sides of each of the World Trade Center buildings before they exploded, imploded, whatever happened, and she calls that lathering up. Well, if you start to read these things, you realize that by ionizing gases and creating a plasma, electrical plasma, out of those gases, and then zapping it with electromagnetic radiation, you can get that effect. Or if you, the vaunted death ray of Tesla was the idea that you would interfere two different wavelengths in a particular way, and Tom Bearden talks about this in his in his talk about Soviet weather engineering of the United States. You could create a scalar situation where the normal laws of physics don't apply.
Right, this may play into this, because the idea of utilizing multiple systems, multiple HAARP systems, creating a standing wave in the upper atmosphere, that kind of discussion has been had. The question is have they done it, and can we document it? And at this point, I've not been able to do it. Perhaps other researchers have. And I know Bearden had done a lot in this area, and we've reviewed his work, and, you know, it's pretty compelling. The questions always come in is, you know, where can you get the independent kind of verifications? And so much of our work has been centered on, you know, what's out there in the public literature to make our case. And so much of the work has been done in a clandestine way where we'll never see the full story in that respect. You know, so you have to either accept marginalized information, or you have to say, well, you know, let's see what else we can correlate. And with Bearden's work over time, I think things have started to correlate. A lot of the things that he and others have said that come out of that, you know, that sort of clandestine world. But time shows all, and I think time has shown that those that have been reporting on this issue over the past couple of decades have been correct, and Bearden is one of them.
Is he still alive, Nick?
I think he may still be. I get material. I think it's from one of his assistants, but I think he still is alive.
I've heard he's been sick, if he is.
Yeah, I think I've been getting from, I get like every few months something comes from someone who's been assisting him that sends material out to a list, and I'm on that list. So I see things coming from his research periodically.
Okay. Well, it seems like, so we can't, or you can't, right, see a direct correlation between what HAARP does and what happened to the World Trade Center buildings, which does seem to be a most unusual phenomenon. Judy Wood would say it was like a demonstration of a new technology as radically different as, say, nuclear technology was when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, almost like a similar demonstration to the world of, look what we can do, back off, because we can do this anywhere.
I think that's...
It seems like with...
I was going to say that's probably a very realistic view of the world. I mean, that's how you do it. The fact is that every country will demonstrate a capacity at some point. The ideal is in a conflict situation. And it's more or less throwing down the gauntlet and saying, hey, you know, we have this now. And I think some of that has been going on. I mean, the kinds of advances in science that are taking place outside of the public view make what we've seen in the world today like driving the Model T. What is coming is going to be literally transformative. And against that transformation has to play in, and I guess that's been a lot of us who have been in this work in getting the public involved, is, does this really line up with the future world we want to see? You know, do these technologies support the kind of independent human living that we believe is necessary, you know, within the context of, you know, of how we want to live? And now you're talking about, and we're talking about, technologies that influence how we behave, not through propaganda and traditional sources of manipulation, but through direct interaction with us, with our mind and bodies, with interference, direct interference, not just propaganda, not just a challenge to our intellect, but the overriding of our capacity to engage the intellect. That is why, over the years, we've considered this to be the most important topic. And, it gets touched on in the HAARP story, but HAARP's become almost a metaphor for so many people. I mean, every time that there's a technologically related disaster, people want to point to HAARP. And while that's interesting, it's not the reason for all of these things, but it doesn't mean that all of these things that people are concerned about aren't necessarily being created by man. There are many weapon systems. HAARP is one of them within a class of weapon systems that are new. And I think that's the big message here is, the technologies have changed so dramatically. It's not just going to be about HAARP. It's going to be about a whole lot of systems that are getting a little bit of notoriety here and there. people come back to HARP because we've leaned on this issue so heavily over the years and tried to get the public aware of sort of the other things that interfere with the planet itself and human beings and living organisms. And HARP has provided a way to explain it because it's the biggest system that can mess things up, if you will. But as I've looked at this over the years, what I've also recognized is the flip side of this equation. These technologies are also a pointer in a direction that we're headed on the planet that will take us either to the point of destruction or the point of revolution, and not in a violent way, but in terms of a revolution in the way we think and the way we behave, based on new knowledge and based on technology, not based on manipulating people to fall into some line. That is the opposite end of what we hope will be the outcome. Good science applied to improving the human condition is a valid and worthy pursuit, but way too much of our science is spent on figuring out how to kill one another, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Judy Wood, who we did interview, and we have her interview archived on Melody's website, her archives, as well as my website, 911NWO.com. She said that, you know, by her technique was she's a materials engineer with a postdoc in optical interferometry. So she understands wavelengths of energy, and she understands mechanical engineering. She understands materials engineering. And she, by doing, you know, analyzing these thousands of photographs, she said, if I didn't know that directed energy weapons existed, I know they do now, because she looked at the materials and saw what happened to those materials. She also said, guess what, guys? Free energy exists. Now, free energy is one of those, you know, kind of, you know, holy grails that people have been talking about and looking at for years and years and years. And, of course, Tesla was ahead of everybody by, you know, at least a century on that. So this, if free energy exists, as the very, very sharp Dr. Judy Wood believes, then, you know, we don't need to be stuck with gas and oil and the pollution and wars and terrorism, whatever, that goes with that. There are alternatives that would make life easier, and I can understand why the ruling elite might not want everybody to get this. They might want to keep it a secret.
I think that's right.
What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that again, energy technologies are about to go through a huge shift, and if you've started monitoring some of the big oil companies, a lot of the biggest ones are selling off assets more than they traditionally would, and not just on the excuse of an oil spill in the Gulf. I think the trend is definitely a different direction, and what's happened is technology is relatively flat today. The ability to exchange ideas is flat today. Anyone can do it. The fact is there's a lot of governments, a lot of countries, a lot of portions and regions of the world that need energy technologies and really don't care about the multinationals and whether or not they maintain their markets, which ultimately so much of the debate is about. More than it is about a crisis, it's about an economic crisis for private corporations that are going to lose their market edge by controlling the energy monopolies of the planet. That's what Tesla was fighting against over 100 years ago before energy was even a big player. He saw it, he visioned it, and he believed that energy should be, in those days, as free as air and water, which today maybe isn't so free when you buy oxygen in Tokyo, I guess. But you know, the whole idea was that energy as a basic component for the industrial era was going to be a necessary ingredient. If you were to stick it on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it would be right down there with food, clothing, and shelter in the 21st century world. And so energy is the answer. A third of our economy is dedicated to energy consumption and production, and in terms of dollars to the economy. Half of our trade deficit is related to petrochemical products coming in the United States from gasoline, oil, jet fuel, raw crude, etc. And to move a different direction to where energy costs essentially become flatter and lower, what does that do? Well, all of a sudden now food production becomes more possible because controlled environmental growing within greenhouse environments is now economic. I mean, if you start to think about what does energy supply, it supplies our food, it supplies our, ultimately, to some degree, our fertilizers because of how they're based, and on and on and on. energy in the 21st century will either liberate us or free us, and the new energies is sort of the revisiting of old ideas is what's going to liberate us. And even in the healing arts, you know, when World War II started is when we went away from the electromechanical kind of models of the body and went heavily into the chemistry approaches, pharmaceutical approaches to health coming out of World War II. But prior to World War II, during the time of Reif and many others, there was a lot of work being done in this area that continues today in many parts of the world. And I think, again, that will be the revolution that sort of is rediscovered, not just in energy but in health sciences, again, based on the same basic underlying principles that are being now applied to military developments to the detriment of humankind, in my personal view.
Dr. Begich, I'm glad to hear you bring up Reif. Now, is his technology being accessible to many of us, or I was kind of getting information that maybe it wasn't quite as attuned as it should be. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'll tell you, there's a lot of people out there selling things that they claim will do certain things, and they have absolutely no clear knowledge of even what they're talking about. And I don't say that lightly, because there is some very good science behind a lot of the things that are being pitched. It's just, it's almost premature in one sense, because it's not linking up the right kind of science with the technologies. You've got a lot of amateurs doing a lot of work, and I don't begrudge that, because the best science, I think, comes from that venue, you know, whether it be an airplane or a coffee maker or a home computer. But we do need to be a little bit cautious, only in this sense, is as we start to look at these things and sort of rediscover Reif, there are others who, independent of Reif, have developed methodologies for determining, like for pathogens, what specific wavelengths will destroy a specific pathogen. The work of Anu Makela in Finland, which is modern work done over the last 40 years, and by her father before her, she's actually broken down wavelengths for virtually every major pathogen and have isolated ways to destroy those. And she's actually been challenged by the medical authorities. Her and her father were challenged a number of years ago in Finland. They sustained through the courts and since that time have trained hundreds of medical practitioners in their method of healing as a legal form of healing in Finland, which is not an unsophisticated country. It's got some of the best science in the world coming out of Finland. It's where cell phones started, for goodness sakes. Whether it's good or bad, it's where it started. And when you think about this, is Reif, you know, he was standing in his time, and a lot of people have gone back and tried to duplicate his hardware and then produce it and create the effects. And that's all great, but you really need the physiological experience and background. And Anu Makela is one of the very few people I know on the planet that has it. And has developed a working model that is exciting and exceptional, and has treated over 20,000 patients between her father's practice and hers over a very long period of time in some of the most chronic disorders, and has had very good success. And essentially using energy as the medium and an understanding of how to manipulate that energy to create health effects.
And do you know if that's available other than just through them?
In Finland, you can get trained. You can go to her website. It's in Finnish and in English. It's emred.fi for Finland. And there's a lot of material there and information there that'll give people sort of an overview of what her research is about. And our website has a lot of material and references to this as well at earthpulse.com.
Okay, so that's how people get a hold of you, is at earthpulse.com.
Right.
Okay, and Dr. Carlson, if you want to give your websites, and I just want to also say this is KHENLPFM 106.9 Salida. Go ahead, Dr. Carlson.
Okay, well, I mentioned earlier my 911NWO.com website, which I've got a lot of material on, trying to understand what actually happened on 911. Of course, it was a conspiracy, but it wasn't by the Muslims. And then I've got another one called www.naturalclimatechange.us, I've just written an 80-page article called Disproofs of the Hypothesis of Unprecedented Catastrophic Man-Caused Climate Change, and proofs that AGW, or anthropogenic climate change, or anthropogenic global warming, is a fraud. So one of the interesting things to me about this whole thing, Nick, I'm a quaternarist. I've studied climates of the past couple million years, the Ice Age, and then as an earth scientist, it's, you know, take it back further. So anybody who's looked at the history of the earth knows that the amount of climate change we saw in the 20th century, which is reputed to be about 1 degree Fahrenheit warming for the planet, although that's that can be debated for a long time, that's very, very small compared to the range of natural climate variability that we've seen in the past.
Right.
Even my own work in Glacier Park shows the mean annual temperatures fluctuated in Glacier Park, Montana, by at least 16 to 18 degrees centigrade, which is about 30 times greater than what we saw in the 20th century. So it's actually rather easy to disprove this hypothesis. And yet, there's an enormous billions of dollars have been spent to prove this bogus hypothesis of man-caused global warming, and embedded in the very definition of geoengineering. Let me read you the definition I've got here on one of my geoengineering is specifically meant to mitigate and resolve the problems of man-caused global warming. Well, man-caused global warming is a fraud, so geoengineering obviously is something else than is being than we're being told. You know, geoengineering, also of course, weather modification and weather warfare all go together. But let me give you the definition of geoengineering as I've read it recently: the deliberate large-scale manipulation of the planetary environment to counteract anthropogenic climate change. So, you know, there is a big hoax going on here, a big fraud, which
right.
is. In the media, it's in the politicians. Our politicians are telling us, you know, that climate change is the greatest threat to civilization in the history of the world, and therefore our John Holdren, our czar of science, is saying, well, we better look at geoengineering as a way to mitigate this terrible warming that humans are causing. Well, these are lies, and people need to see through them as lies. What's
whole
your
idea
take on that?
I agree with you that it is nature, not man, creating the problem. And it certainly is a big money machine for a whole lot of folks. I mean, any grant you apply for, if you hook on climate change, you got a higher probability of getting it, even if it's totally unrelated. But, you know, when you look at that whole trend, it's been grabbed hold of by the environmental community more than anyone else as again, sort of the banter of how to shut everything down on the planet. And I don't think it is man-made. I mean, here in Alaska, we've seen in my lifetime, of course, you've seen a big change in glaciation up here that I can actually, you know, point to and say, yeah, I saw it when it was there and it's not there anymore. But at the same time, climate change, as we've seen in the last few weeks, means a lot of things to a lot of different people. You're living in Miami at 37 degrees last week. You know, you're thinking about climate change not being very warm. But it is disruptive, and nature does this. And periodically, this is what happens. I mean, 12,000 years ago, we had glaciers running all the way through the Midwest. They're gone. That's not very long in geologic times. You know, 10, 12,000 years is a twinkling in the eye. I think what we're experiencing is normal oscillations. Yeah, mankind is aggravating it, but like a fly on the camel's back.
Well, you know, and that's my next question to you, Nick, is, you know, people do talk about extreme weather, and then often the politicians or the media will point to that as evidence of, you know, climate disruption, and it's our fault for driving SUVs. However, I think it's more likely that extreme weather events of the last 10 years could have been produced by HARP. And certainly we saw the Soviets doing that to us in the 80s, according
right.
to Tom Bearden. And so the technology was there in the 80s, certainly there now.
Absolutely.
What do you think?
Well, I think
what can we attribute?
I think they've been experimenting, and those experiments result in unexpected outcomes. And I think we've had some unexpected outcomes as well. And that will continue as long as experimentation in this area is allowed. And within the treaties, you can experiment within the boundaries of your own country, because treaties don't recognize that political boundaries on a map are totally non-existent in the real world of nature. You know, it doesn't stop because you have a line on a map. Clouds move, weather systems move, and so you affect something in one area, you can create a downline, unanticipated and significant effect. The other thing that comes into mind is you think about a few places on the planet that have been hostile to American policy, and just as an aside, take a look at North Korea. You know, South Korea seems to get plenty of rain, seems to be able to grow crops, run an economy, function, and you go across the border and the lights are out. You know, the economy is depressed and the weather is such that you can't even grow anything. You know, a lot of this, this is exactly the kind of thing that Rumsfeld was elaborating on, what he was excited about, was the idea you could actually embargo a country and they wouldn't even know it, and you embargo them with weather. That's pretty profound because, I mean, how do you fight that? I mean, how do you declare your adversary the weather? And that's what it's about. It's about creating an environment of warfare where you can wage war without the political niceties of a conversation. And that's what's going on today.
Now, can you affect the jet stream in the air? Can you affect the Gulf Stream or ocean currents with this sort of mechanism?
I don't think so. Not directly, maybe indirectly by affecting other weather conditions to affect things. But the ocean holds a tremendous amount of heat, and that amount of heat is released relatively slowly, and the heat drives a lot of the systems. Something not factored in that should be factored in is undersea volcanics. People look at the they think of ozone depletion as creating a situation where the ocean's heat, and it's ridiculous because firstly, solar radiation, when it hits the surface of the ocean, most of the solar radiation is reflected. 70% is reflected away. About 30% is absorbed, and it's absorbed as heat into the surface of the oceans because as soon as you drop a few feet, the temperature gradient drops as well, and heat rises. So any heat being dissipated, is going to be dissipated on the surface, whereas undersea volcanics and under the South Pacific alone, there's 1,200 charted volcanoes. At any given time, a number of them are discharging. In that case, 100%, all of the heat energy is absorbed into the oceans. And then if you were to observe it from a satellite, it would look like a plume, which makes a whole lot of more sense for what we're observing within the oceans in El Nino events than solar warming from a hole in the ozone layer. That just does not make
sense. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, that's very good discussion. I think everything you said is right. You mentioned North Korea as a possible example of kind of a covert use of HAARP-like technology. Can you think of other examples? I've heard of earthquakes in Iran, and of course people
right.
speculate about the Haiti earthquake. They speculate about the Chilean earthquake, which was timed, I think, just the same day as the new president took office. They speculate even about Hurricane Katrina being guided to its destination. Do you understand well enough the fingerprints of the HAARP activity as opposed to, say, just natural phenomenon? Is it impossible to distinguish one from the other, or can we start to suggest, okay, this is HAARP?
I think there's ways to do it, but it requires independent monitoring because nature does not tend to present coherent, rhythmic-type signals, whereas these artificial man-made systems exploit very specific ranges of frequency. So any government that has the capability will recognize those signals. They're very clear. It's not like hiding a nuke in a silo. This is going to create a footprint as soon as you discharge it that any sophisticated government with monitoring capacity will pick that signal out and know exactly where it originated from. And that's why, in this sense, this kind of technology could be easily monitored with very heavy consequences for people that abuse it, because we're talking about the entire mechanism of the planet and the effect of every living organism on it.
Are you familiar with the World Meteorological Organization?
I know of them, but not any more than that.
Okay, because, I mean, they as it's described on the website, it's like the official United Nations authoritative voice on weather, climate, and water, scientific organization. I just...
Yeah.
Nick, going back to your monitoring thing, I saw on some website, and I, you know, as an article, I can't verify everything I see, but this article pointed out, it showed locations in the world during 1 week period of time, I think a couple of years ago, where there were 4.2 earthquakes, or in the order of 4 or 5 point earthquakes, magnitude 4 or 5. All of which were at 10 kilometers depth. And that would suggest, of course, that pattern would suggest, of course, not a random system that caused by natural processes, but a system that was deliberate.
Well, and this is the kind of thing you would look for. You know, I mean, nature doesn't tend to do that. As you said, it tends to be a little more random. To see events occurring at the exact same depth in various locations would cause me at least to question it and look further. And ultimately, it's independent monitoring that will make a difference. And there really isn't any that I've seen on a scale that I would consider credible. And I haven't seen everything either. I know there's a lot of people looking at this issue now more than there ever was before. And I think that's great. I mean, that's what it's going to take to resolve these things. There's a lot more scrutiny by a lot more people. With the requisite backgrounds and hardware to make the observations. And, you know, I think we're headed down a direction that is not all doom and gloom either. You know, I mean, the fact that we're moving in this way, there's an opportunity in all of this, the other side of the sword, so to speak, to where the science might be used in a more beneficial way. Some of the climate change science I'm very skeptical of, only because of the potential risk. We need to move very, very slowly in many of these areas to not make the kind of mistakes that history has shown us we've made in the past. And we don't have the luxury that we had in the past because things change so rapidly, the technologies advance so rapidly, it forces us into this sort of high-speed chase for the next solution, while at the same time we may be creating, and in fact we are, other problems we'll one day have to resolve.
Well, of course, I would argue that the global warming fraud, and I have to just call it a fraud, it's a multi-decadal plan, and of course, one of the goals is global problems require global solutions. We hear, you know, Gordon Brown and people around the world saying that, okay, this is a global problem, can't be dealt with by any single government, so we have to let the UN handle it, blah, blah, blah. So there's this desperate attempt, or has been a desperate attempt, to create the perception of global problems that would require a global governing body and global taxes, and we know that there is a cadre or a cabal that has wanted global government for a long time, and this is one way to kind of stampede public opinion, I think, in that direction. But I am very fascinated with the you I think know a lot about the issue of mind control and HAARP. You also see a positive potential here. Could we talk a little bit about the first of all the mind control aspect, which is very spooky, and then maybe move it in a more positive direction?
Yeah, as it relates to HAARP or just generally, this.
Well, HAARP, but yeah, generally as well.
Well, we published a book called Controlling the Human Mind, which really got into this way beyond, you know, HAARP. This issue came up because anytime you can manipulate radio frequency in this way, and when you go back, as we'd mentioned in the last hour, the work of J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who said if you could ever electronically stroke the ionosphere in a certain way, you'd manipulate the behavior of, you know, everyone in contact with the signal. And what was shown there, basically, you know, was how easy it was. You know, for us, I look at that and I go, okay, HAARP is the biggest single system. It is what they did not have when Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote his thing and when J.F. Gordon MacDonald wrote theirs. There was no system to electronically stroke the ionosphere in a way that would create that signal until they developed HAARP. Now you have a system that can, in fact, deliver on that promise in a pretty dramatic way. And And that's sort of the ultimate side of the spectrum. That's using the Earth's electromagnetic character to carry a signal, in a sense, as opposed to what the U.S. Army War College article that I had mentioned earlier, The Mind Has No Firewalls, it talks about sort of the individual and the various carriers that can affect an individual in terms of things that we're used to hearing about, radio, TV, internet, electrical grids. But when you think about something on a mass scale, then you think of heart. The fact is, any electromagnetic carrier can carry a signal in that will influence the behavior of people if the operator knows what they're doing. And it's as simple as that. Whether you want a large-scale system like HARP or something smaller that's more contained in terms of a power grid or a radio broadcast area, in other words, you can target based upon the carrier you use, who's listening, so to speak. If you're, and we did this in the first Gulf War. Scottish media reported it. We used we piggybacked a signal on the signals that were broadcasting the Muslim music and prayers every day over their radio broadcast systems. We sent a signal in that coupled with that, that carried into those environments, and according to Scottish media, created fear and panic on the part of listeners, and then you saw the fourth largest army in the world collapse like a bunch of school children in a fire drill. And that was in the first Gulf War. And this is the kind of system and the kind of direction that we see happening increasingly in warfare. In fact, there's new initiatives by DARPA to create new weapon systems that will exploit the possibility of overriding human consciousness in a way that you can literally shut down your adversaries without destroying all the property. And that, from a rebuild perspective, offers some opportunities and at the same time some challenges. And the bigger challenge to all of this is the foundational question. Should human beings be interfering with the way other human beings think by directly overriding their biological systems? I think the answer to that is a resounding no, that it violates the very essence of what we are as human beings, the very essence of who we are as conscious human beings, and no one has a right to interfere with my thinking processes, is my view of the world. And one thing to have an intellectual discussion and debate, if you want to call that interference, it's another to directly interfere with the biological mechanisms that allow you to think freely and clearly.
Okay, so the human mind is more or less at the wavelength of about 2, or gives off wavelengths, or picks up signals at about 2 to 10 hertz. Is that correct? And that's like you say, that's about the same wavelength as the Earth. Is that correct?
For certain things, I'd say yeah, but you can use a lot of different wavelengths. Those in particular are going to correlate with the Earth's natural rhythm is about 7 hertz, more or less, between 7 and 8 hertz at pulses per second. That's the same range as the human brain is in its low alpha, high theta ranges, which is sort of your ideal place for creative work and creative thinking. But surrounding us is a 60 hertz grid in the U.S. and 50 hertz in Europe, and that's a higher frequency. It's still considered extremely low frequency in terms of its range, but has a very different effect. Instead of a calming effect of the 8 to 10 hertz range, you get an agitating effect at 50 and 60 hertz, effect that creates an underlying stress and anxiety in the population that actually shuts down your ability to reach higher states of consciousness. It's the easiest form of manipulation because you cannot reach your higher states of consciousness where you need to be if you're in a state of worry or fear. In fact, if you look at EEGs of people in worry and fear, you see incoherent brain patterns, kind that aren't associated with clear intellectual processes or any higher ordered thinking. You take away fear and anxiety and worry and substitute positive emotions, love, compassion, empathy, and you get coherent rhythmic patterns that are associated with high ordered thinking and anomalous human capabilities, those things that we don't readily explain. We used to call it ESP. Some people call them gifts of the spirit. Some people call them a lot of other things. But the reality is these higher levels of consciousness can only take place in an environment free of fear and worry. So the easiest form of manipulation of populations is exactly what we're seeing. enhance the fear and worry. Don't worry about it. Your herd will move wherever you direct them. And that's exactly what's happening here in the U.S. and elsewhere. It's the simplest form. The key element here, and a very important piece of information, is you cannot, and I want to say it again loudly, you cannot reach your higher states of awareness and consciousness in a state of fear. And this is the building block of so much of what has worked against us, is our world exists on it. I mean, think about the advertising you see every day. It's all about worrying about how you look, how you feel, how you smell, how your teeth look. I mean, just think about all of it. It's all based on exacerbating insecurities, increasing worry and fear, because it's the quickest and easiest motivator. Ask any Baptist minister, he'll tell you. You know, you want to get people to move, scare the hell out of them on Sunday. The problem is on Monday, everybody goes back to whatever they're doing. It doesn't last, and it doesn't create lasting change. Real change comes from competent people, confident in what they're doing, thinking clearly and thinking freely, and that comes in an environment free of fear and worry. And that's the first and only step that's needed to start to change the direction in which this planet is going. We have to shake that loose. We have to find ways to overcome that. And that's the flip side of this equation. You know, when I look at the research done in the mind effects area and done by our government, and in the book Controlling the Human Mind, we used over 250 sources, primarily government documents, explaining sort of how this works and then more or less what has been happening. But the biggest discovery out of all of that isn't what everyone worries about, you know, creating some kind of Manchurian candidate or manipulating what we say and what we do. You know, everyone defaults to that. But the bigger issue for military researchers was at the same time they were researching this, they were also researching extrasensory perceptions, or what they used to call in the 70s paraphysics. And in all of that, what they found was that human beings were much more than they thought we were. We have these unique characteristics, these innate capabilities that don't function very well if we're in fear and worry. But if they do function very well, it scares the hell out of those that organize systems. Because truly engaged, actualized human beings are unstoppable by any measure. And the fact of the matter is, human beings does not take a lot of us to create a lot of change. Every major change in the world started with one or two people seeing it just a little differently, and then not letting go of it. And I think that's the generation we're in now. We have the opportunity to rediscover what we are as human beings and use our science to open up those attributes and open up those capabilities and really change the face of the planet as a result. That is the mechanism for change, dealing with the fear and the worry of the world and these topics that we've covered today. The only way that it changes is we fundamentally change, and then we start acting in the full capacity of humans. And I think that's what we're going to see emerge out of all of this. And so much has already happened, in my estimation, that are indicators for this change in direction and this change in the way we perceive the world around us.
Well, this is fascinating. Now, you talked about how kind of the background of 60 Hertz in this country. What's the source of that? Is that television? Is that radio waves? What would that be?
That's the entire power grid, 110 volts, 60 hertz. You know, take a look at your outlet. Everything that you have that runs and plug into a wall is 60 hertz. And so those 60 hertz signals surround us through the power grid, running through our house, running around our homes and throughout our communities. It's the power grid itself runs at 60 hertz. And that's the constant vibration that you feel. And I'll tell you when you feel it, is when the power goes out and everything's quiet. You notice how quiet it is because all the fans have stopped. But the other thing you notice is your whole body exhales. It's almost like your whole body goes limp for a second. It's just like a big relaxed moment when the power goes out, because no longer is your body compensating for 60 hertz on a constant basis, plus all of the other wireless signals running through your neighborhood. When the power goes down and all those signals stop, it's not only the silence that from the auditory changes, but the actual silence that your body feels, the ability to finally relax, to no longer compensate for those external subtle fields that impact us every day, like the noise in a crowded room that we found a way to ignore. And it's the same is true here. We're born into the sound of an explosion, electromagnetic explosion at birth, and we perceive it as silence. And that's really it. When the power goes out, then we understand what silence is.
Wasn't that a discussion?
You know, right out of college, I jumped. I had an opportunity to herd sheep on the Navajo reservation for a month or two, and there was no electricity. There was only a kerosene lamp and a little outhouse. And I look back on that 2 months as being amongst the happiest of my life. I guess you perhaps provided a good explanation for why that's the case.
Well, I think so. I work in a very remote place where you can't get any signals for a few weeks every summer. And it is a huge, huge difference in your clarity of thought, in the way you function. And people say, oh, you're out in the country, you know, that's the way it is. Well, there's a reason for it, and these are the reasons. This is why if you live in New York City all your life, most New Yorkers go back because something's missing. You know, they get out of New York City, they get out of that tension, and they're at a loss. It's like, whoa, something is definitely up here. Now, some people manage to escape, but most go back. And it's because it's what they're familiar with. And if you think about the general agitation in urban areas, it's not just about overcrowding. It's what we've done within those urban areas that have also created this underlying stress. And these are the things that contribute to that. And more so than we have acknowledged, I think, in terms of the modern world and how we view physical health. But as time moves on, and I say it again, within the next 20, 30 years, this is going to be generally understood, and people are going to begin and developing systems that compensate for it. I mean, switching, moving things around, shielding them a little differently, you can mitigate a lot of these problems. It's like even with things like cell phones. You know, you cut the power densities down, you change their design a little bit, so now the people don't have them next to their head. They're all busy texting, so they get them away from the body. You end up just changing the way you work with technologies might actually affect the nature of the impact on health. And the same is true here. As we gain the understanding and people are more willing to discuss it, we can develop systems that fix the problems that our technologies have yielded. But we need a much different approach, and we need a little bit more open approach that can respond to issues as they're raised. In Europe, they use the precautionary principle, which says essentially once you start getting evidence that there's a problem, you let the public know, and you let the public make their own decisions based on that knowledge. You don't wait till it's conclusive, absolute, every scientist in the world agrees. You start letting the public know early. Now, they've done this for over 40 years in Europe, and the consequence is over 40 years on health and environmental issues, they have never once been wrong. That says a lot, and it's a message to the rest of us. As acceleration of technology moves forward, perhaps a precautionary principle is one we should apply in the United States as effectively as has been applied in Europe. And it certainly hasn't stopped advancements in technology in Europe, but it certainly has helped safeguard the public.
Do you feel like
just to go back to this 60 volts thing, or 110 volts, 60 hertz, even if you have a refrigerator on, would that therefore have the same effect?
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to have it on. You've got the power grid running through your house. I mean, you've got it surrounding you. You've got wiring in virtually every wall. Today now, you have then the complications of wireless. You know, like where I'm sitting right now, I get the pleasure of being able to notice all of my neighbors' wireless connections because they're running right through me, too. So I see on my computer screen, you know, the options of connecting to the wireless world, and I see 20 options. Well, I got 20 signals coming through my living room that weren't here 10 years ago. You know, is that an intrusion in my life? I think it is. Is it regulated adequately? I don't think it is. And the reality is time will show that we are correct, that these signals did have and do have a deleterious effect on human bodies and human health. And you see it in a number of different ways. And here, the problem is now you have all this compound. You have new chemicals and constituents. And if you remember what I said about energy's interaction with each chemical and constituent, now you've got a soup of chemicals throughout the environment and overlaying that a soup of electromagnetic radiation sources operating in various frequencies, triggering the chemistry in a way that is not well understood and certainly cannot be easily deduced from the soup we've created around us. And as we sort of sort that out and get a better understanding of it, we'll find ways, and I'm certain of this, we will find ways to work within the technologies, within ranges that are safe or even helpful. Certain energy frequencies produce healthful effects. And so having that understanding and apply it to what we're developing in technology can actually change it from something that is damaging to something that can be quite useful on other levels that we didn't even anticipate. And that's where this science of electromagnetic effects on health and in the environment will take a very big change for the rest of society as society catches up with the research.
Yeah, well, let's hear about that. What can we expect in the way of positive, or what might we look forward to in the way of positive developments in terms of our health system, et cetera?
Well, some things that have already, you know, already show up in the literature that are not well explained, but, you know, rapid tissue regeneration. I know of at least one patent that's pending in FDA that's in its second stage for pain mitigation, as another example, using electromagnetic fields to knock out pain, not in the traditional way of tens units or other units essentially override the signal, but in a way that actually changes the body and actually enhances the healing process. And I've seen the work on that. I've seen this particular tool demonstrated. Other areas where I think we're going to see some additional breakthroughs that have already started to manifest more and more in educational systems is the use of neurobiofeedback, something that's been around for 40 years, now being applied in educational institutions to substitute for psychoactive drugs like Ritalin and things that are designed to either slow the brain down or speed the brain up for kids that have attention disorders. What they're finding is that you can actually train the brain to function within a range that will be ideal for learning, for meditation, for sleep, whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. And you can learn how to do this through biofeedback techniques, or you can even drive these signals by external signals. Same kind of signals being used to disturb a person can be used to enhance your learning capacity, as an example. Flickering light, bioral beat and sound, electrocranial stimulation, a lot of different methods have been developed and are advancing that allow us the ability to gain greater control over our brain functions in a deliberate way that we're in control of. Those are exciting areas. And from my perspective, the flip side of the coin on all of this research is the advancement of science in a way that enhances our capacity as individuals and our independence as individuals.
Well, do you find that
going back to Nikola Tesla, I think it's the same problem that he had. I think Nikola Tesla was this genius. His father, I believe, was a minister, and he spent his life as a bachelor altruistically trying to develop technologies that would help people. And of course, J.P. Morgan, the financier, now we understand some people say agent of the Rothschild family in Europe, he funded Tesla up until the point where he didn't like where this research was taking him. He said, well, if the energy's free, where can I put a meter on it? You know, and
right.
At that point he cut off the funding, and old Nikola Tesla was not able to complete his Wardenclyffe Tower, which was going to deliver wireless energy around the world. And so there was the great genius, the altruist, the inventor, who was controlled ultimately by the financier, who was, driven primarily by greed and selfishness. And this seems to be our dilemma today, where we have great scientists who are capable of making great strides, who want to use those technologies for the benefit of other people, but then we have a financial system which seems to be under the control of individuals who don't have that altruistic motivation. So it seems like we're that story is writ large across the world today.
Well, I think it's not going to be the normal mechanism. I mean, if anyone ever comes up with a free energy device that is truly available, the only way it's going to come out is if they put it out there on the internet essentially for free, because otherwise they're not going to make it to the bank to cash the first check. I mean, it's just too many interests that are damaged by that kind of outcome. But I think a lot of the information, the freeness of information, the ability to move forward, I think we're going to see things not coming out of the mainstream labs. I mean, the best inventions in the world, I got to say, have not come out of some Ivy League program. They've come out of some guy with absolute perseverance and enough ignorance to do something new. Because you look at the airplane, that's a good example. Nobody, every scientist in the world of any credibility said, no way will anything heavier than air like this ever fly. You know, just no way. And yet, a couple guys who are bicycle repairmen managed to make that work. Well, a couple guys in a garage decided that home computers were a good idea when no one could even vision it. And here we have on every desktop and wristwatch, telephone, a computer now. You know, the people who do things truly in the world have to see it a little bit differently. And I think that is what we need to see in this generation as well. The greatest challenges aren't in sort of massaging the status quo. It's in recognizing where the status quo has failed and creating elegant solutions. And I think there's a lot of elegant solutions coming. And it depends upon the mechanism by which they come forward. You know, if people follow the standard rules of, you know, you develop something, you take it to the patent office, and you patent it, and you think everything is rosy. Well, you're mistaken, because within the patent office, if you have any profound technology that can be used in any military fashion, your patent will be confiscated, and you will never be able to work on it outside of a government lab again. And this happens thousands of times every year in the United States alone. So real technology that creates this kind of change and at the same time create what for some becomes national security questions, those are going to come through a different channel than the normal one that people have used in the past. It's going to have to come through a different vehicle, even to the point of people with good theoretical models need to take it the next step and actually develop the technologies. You know, you have a free energy machine, if you really do, then make it and sell it. You know, I mean, that's why waste your time for the next 20 years arguing with the academic community. If you really have something, start to build it, put it out there in a way that does not create economic risk for anyone, and you've got an opportunity to create something and move it forward. It's just that usually these devices don't work. They turn into frauds. They require a lot of people. But I think there will be a time when people figure out a different mechanism, and the best is produce it. If it works, people will buy it. If it works really well, they'll buy a lot of them. And if it works really, really well, you won't have a problem. And you don't have to worry about the patent office. It's too late then. It's already in the market. And that's the only way these innovative technologies will ever come to be, is they're going to have to hit the market in a way that preempts objection.
So do you feel like there's different...
Melody, I'm sorry, I cut you off last time.
So what we see here is two different... two major philosophical dialectics taking place here behind, you know, the altruistic method and then the militaristic corporate method that seem to be in opposition to each other more
right.
So than accomplishing things for humanity. Are you follow any of the, like, this resonance when you're talking about, you know, what possibly maybe could be done by HARP or other methods, you know, like you're talking with, that could affect genetics?
Well, once again, you know, if you have enough knowledge to understand the underlying mechanism, the question is, can you affect it with an external device, you know, whether it be electromagnetic charge or whether it be a chemical ingested in the body? And you know, these are the areas that I think are advancing pretty rapidly. This is the area where electromedicine will take its form in the U.S. and around the world in a more accurate way, in a more efficient way. And actually going back many decades to where we sort of broke off that approach. There were Jose Delgado, who was well known at Yale University for his work in mind effects, he actually got his degree in electrophysiology in 1950. Now, that's 60 years ago, and most people don't even know a degree in electrophysiology exists today, much less 60 years ago. But that was University of Madrid, well-respected university, and He went on to Yale to map the brain and figure out what parts of the brain are affected by what, you know, by what, and then was able to influence those with electrodes implanted in the brain and stimulating them. And then he was able to manipulate people using radio frequency energy with no electrodes, just by manipulating specific ranges of frequency that would affect specific parts of the brain to create the outcomes that he was looking for. And he did that back in the 1960s through the 1980s. By the mid-80s, he was using just RF, radio frequency. So the research goes back, the science goes back, but it's not the kind of science you read about in the mainstream. you really don't. Mm-hmm. And yet the science is there if you look for it.
Yeah, I have a connection that I think is kind of interesting on this. You know, as a geography professor, you know, we talk about the electromagnetic spectrum. We talk about the fact that every body that exists with a temperature above absolute zero gives off electromagnetic radiation. Okay, you can't see it, but, and then, of course, the hotter the body, the more electromagnetic radiation is given off, and the shorter the wavelengths are emitted. Just to jump a little bit to the problems of what are the causes of climate change, and of course the idea that humans driving SUVs and adding a little bit of carbon dioxide is not even in the top 100 possibilities. There are many factors that influence climate change, and one of the more interesting ones now, I think, that I read from, you know, scientists around the world, is that, you know, the sun has an electromagnetic field, and
right.
So does the Earth, and the Earth, of course, revolving around the sun, and the Earth has its electromagnetic field, and the interaction of these electromagnetic fields, not only, of course, you got the moon, and then you got the other planets too, that these set up resonances that give periodicities, and some of these periodicities can be discerned in the climatic record, although the climatic record is very complex. But one
right.
of the more interesting theories I've heard recently is that the interaction of these electromagnetic fields would have a lot to do with the patterns of climate change. And now we have a mechanism. There's a group of scientists in Denmark who actually set up a laboratory to experiment with this. And what they find out is when there's more cosmic rays coming in, that these cosmic rays that bombard our atmosphere act as condensation nuclei, and they therefore create little water droplets, and of course the water droplets, when there's enough of them, create clouds. And now the connection here is that when the sun's magnetic field is more intense, when there's more sunspots, for instance, then the electromagnetic field, the atmosphere of the sun, you might say, is more intense, and it blocks more incoming cosmic rays from outside our solar system. And at that time, when there's less cosmic rays coming in, there's less clouds, the temperatures seem to be slightly warmer. So now we have a mechanism that would explain why sunspot cycles of 11 and 22 years could have a direct effect on temperatures and precipitation in our climate system. Well, the mediator of that process was invisible, wasn't it? It was the cosmic rays, and it was the electromagnetic fields. And
right.
I think probably we're going to, as our understanding is more sophisticated, we'll understand how to fine-tune the human system in this regard, too.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And you know, the observations of solar activity and the, if you really look at that, you know, you look at the carbon footprint associated with climate change that they try to associate, and then if you actually look at the increases in carbon in our atmosphere, and you chart that, you know, really starting at World War II. And if you look at that, you would expect to see global warming consistently from the 40s all the way on, and yet it was cooling from the 40s through the 60s.
Yeah.
It was doing just the opposite.
From the 70s,
you're talking about
1975, right?
Yep, and if you look at
a good correlation.
No, but if you look at a solar model of climate change, and you look at the sunspot activity and the solar radiation coming from the sun, and you were to chart that, you see a direct correlation. It makes sense. You know, it actually does make sense.
Yeah.
But it's a natural phenomena is what makes sense. And if you look at the changes in ocean temperatures, which, again, people will say, oh, that takes, you know, a century to, you know, move up a few degrees. Well, That's true if you're using the solar model for how heat is transferred into the oceans, but if you use a volcanic model for how heat might be more largely transmitted into the oceans, it may actually make a lot more sense, and it does. We published that in 95, and I still haven't seen it in the science literature, but I'm sure it will emerge, that you're going to see theories advanced about this other mechanism for creating climate change. And it's the most obvious one because the ocean is a huge heat sink. It drives weather systems. We all know that. But how it releases and retains heat is the underlying sort of mechanism of that. So you know, these things start to make a lot more sense if you look at them in a multidisciplinary fashion. The atmospheric scientist isn't talking to the volcanologist. That's a problem. The fact the volcanologist isn't talking to ocean scientists, that's a problem. The fact physicists aren't talking about the physical effects of light and heat within ocean water and relating it to these earth sciences is a problem. Integrated science is an answer to some of this, and our science in the West has followed the opposite. Where the most money is spent in science is in military science, where it's compartmentalized, deliberately separated and broken down into its smallest component, so no one ever sees what the other guy is doing. And it's very inefficient, very expensive, leads to lots of duplication, and ultimately leads to problems that are not anticipated. The Russian model that they followed along the same period of time during the Cold War was the opposite. They integrated multidisciplinary teams and, as a result, had a more coherent science, number one. But number two, economically, they were never the machine. We were half the world's economy, for God's sake. They weren't even close, and yet they could keep up and in some areas surpass us in science. How does that work? Well, it works because they use multidisciplinary teams and use the intelligence of a lot of good thinkers and not assume that everybody knows everything, and it's been a couple thousand years since anyone arrived with that claim that anybody gave any validity to. So as I look at it, and I look at sort of where the science is shaping, integrated science is important, which is why this sort of flow of information through internet and other activities open opportunities for people who aren't thought about as scientists, are the individual thinkers, are those creative people dabbling in science. And I encourage them from the standpoint that the best science is likely to come there, but I also encourage them to be cautious because a lot of mistakes come from there too. But we can see the opportunities, and the opportunities are going to be in broader thinking and with people with access to information so they can apply their own creative twist to the science of this century. And I think we're going to get through this in a very positive way despite all the doom and gloom surrounding us today.
Dr. Begich, now when you were saying that you didn't think that we had that much involved with possibly the ocean currents, but if we could affect the volcanic activity or earthquakes with this type of energy, would that then possibly be that third party or indirect method you're talking about?
Yeah, and that's what I was referring to as a direct method of HARP creating effect on currents. I couldn't see it. But a secondary effect, affecting something else and then triggering some other event. Yeah, and that's exactly what you're talking about. If you trigger volcanic eruptions, which our past Secretary of Defense believed we could do back in the 90s, yeah, I mean, if you could do that, then you can change ocean temperatures and you can change ocean currents and you can change the whole, you can dump a lot of snow in Europe if you can alter those currents enough. Question is it man-made or is it natural? And now it's confusing because man has the capability. And this is what comes back to HARP again. Every time something happens now, because people in their consciousness know we can do this, people want to attribute it to the one technology they can point to, which is HARP. It is not the only technology. I want to say that very loudly. There are a lot of parallel technologies working in other areas, but exploiting the same basic science, understanding that it's energy and energy's interaction that drive biological and geophysical mechanisms more than we ever anticipated or understood before. And as that understanding grows, our ability to manipulate these systems also grows, and our risk to all of us grows with it when it's done in a closet by military planners. And I'm not an anti-military person. I believe strong militaries are relevant and needed on the planet, unfortunately, still today. But they are needed. But their mission is one that is very narrow. Their mission is to anticipate every horrible situation you can ever anticipate man engaging in or nature engaging in, and then building a plan around it, which requires a very different kind of mindset and thinking, and one that is relegated to the military, and it's a difficult task. But when you think about the paranoid thinking that it creates,
yeah.
where everyone is your adversary, that's why militaries do not run governments in the West, why civilians run governments, and the military is in the closet until we need them. And then we pull them out because they have that narrow mission. And when we pull them out, it's like, you know, you're cocking the gun. You know, bad things are going to happen to somebody. And that's when we use our military, and that's the appropriate places when we have to. But again, that thinking should not dominate our political arena, because that thinking leads to a more directed and controlled society where everyone is a villain, which is exactly what we've all seen emerge coming out of 9/11. That has to reverse in order for humanity to regain its footing. Because of a few bad guys, we cannot eliminate the possibilities for humankind.
One other thing, I believe I caught on one of your videos something that had to do with the Gulf Stream or Gulf disaster we've got going down there. Have you covered anything along that lines, or do you have anything to say about it, or tie that in anything with what you know you had to deal with in Alaska?
You mean the Gulf oil spill?
Yeah, yes.
Issue. You know, it's really a separate issue. You know, British Petroleum has a lousy record here in Alaska. In fact, I mean, it's pretty horrible in terms of what has happened here historically. And now they're trying to sell a lot of their assets on the North Slope of Alaska because they haven't bothered to replace pipes and all of the things that run that oil field up there that produces 25% of the oil in the United States. And unfortunately, the lack of maintenance has created we've already seen a few small disasters, but what is coming is much worse. And if they don't get on it, we're going to have serious problems, not just with an energy supply, but with environmental issues here in Alaska for lack of maintenance and lack of consideration, because BP's policy in Alaska was wait till it breaks and then fix it. Well, you know, that doesn't present the rest of us who rely on corporate responsibility at any level. That doesn't give us the kind of confidence we'd like to have with our corporate partners in Alaska and anywhere else in the world. And the reality is the oil industry and other extractive industries have taken, you know, some very bad positions historically. And how do you make them accountable? I think we need more whistleblower mechanisms that apply to governments and private industry, that when people are engaged in activity that is either illegal or places humanity at risk, there ought to be a way to blow the whistle and get the public's attention. And those mechanisms do not exist. And they should. They should exist through commercial, environmental, and all areas of law. And I'll give you a good example, a very simple example. While Obama was in India talking about all these great opportunities for American companies, I happened to know an American company that was doing business in India that very same week. And in that very same week, they'd been offered an opportunity to bid on an Indian government contract for over $20 million, which was a great opportunity for that American company, until their Indian counterpart had to explain they had to pay the 15% government bribes in order to get that contract. And at the same time, you know, if you, as an American, were to pay those bribes, you're going to prison. You're going to prison for a very, very long time, because those cases are aggressively pursued here in the United States. So how do you create an equal footing? How is it that you can ever compete in governments and countries that exist on corruption? And you have to create a system that recognizes their values, and their values are corruption. So you need to reward people for the truth. You need to bribe people to tell the truth. You need to give them a reward, you know, instead of the 10%, which was the price, or the 15% on that contract. Give the whistleblower 10% of whatever was to be ill-gotten in that game. You know, create a mechanism by which bribery for the truth pays. And you might change some of the underlying rot in some of these countries that preclude opportunity and their own growth. Look at Mexico at our border. You know, I mean, you got a country where 30,000 people have died in the last 4 years along the border, more than in two wars that we're fighting right now. Innocent people killed on the border with the most corrupt government next door to us that you could ever imagine, and we're propping it up. What is wrong with this? Do they have lack of economic opportunity? Do they have lack of natural resources? No. Per capita, Mexico has more natural resources than we do. It's a distribution problem because of greed and corruption at the top, and there's no mechanism for cleaning it out. I won't even mail to Mexico because their mail system is so unreliable, I can't get anything through. You know, I have not mailed to Mexico in over 15 years because of that. Think about that at our southern border. We want to talk about security. Then we have to first talk about honesty, truth, and transparency in government, not just our own. And we have to allow for people to have their own revolutions, including Mexico, which have tried a couple of times, and we've thwarted it. People are entitled to self-determination in their government, and whether we agree with that form of government or not, they have the latitude and should have the human respect to create their own form of government as we did. In Iraq and Iran, what's the problem? The problem is they're not democratic thinking people. They're not looking for the democratic republic that we have. They're not. We're imposing it, just the same as the Russians showing up trying to impose communism or the Christians showing up trying to impose Christianity. It doesn't matter what you're imposing on someone. People have a right to self-determination, and we have to learn to respect it as long as people stay within their own boundaries. And the U.S. has been, unfortunately, you know, I mean, we're one of the worst at interfering with other people's business. I mean, why is the guy from WikiLeaks getting so much heat for dumping all that material out there? Because the truth hurts, ladies and gentlemen, and the truth is our government is culpable for much of the problems we face in the world today. And we need to reconcile that because Americans, individuals, are not culpable. But we need to take control of our governments again, reroute them into a realm of transparency again, and be able to look into our governments and direct them as citizens the way it was intended to be. And that means diversity in governments around the world. That means there's going to be forms of government that we don't understand and we can't relate to. But people are entitled to that as long as they stay, again, within their own boundaries. And
you know,
people should be allowed to live.
The model there, though, is it seems as though it's hard to tell between a corporation and a government anymore. And when you have a corporation that has no, ultimately, no ethics,
yeah,
which it's kind of hard to, as long as we have that corporate model, it's going to be kind of hard to, you know, bring ethics into that that paradigm.
Well, it falls apart when economies fall apart, and you know we're in that now. And this is the beginning of a longer term trend for the country. And you know, unfortunately, it's in the bad times that we realize you know that things are not what we thought they were, and people start to change. And I think we're in that period again now. Is we're in a period of unrest both within the United States and around the world for lots of different reasons. And in that offers an opportunity for people to rediscover what we are individually and begin to act in our own self-interest in a much different way. I think that's the challenge of this century and of this decade, mm-hmm. is to recognize what is possible and begin acting individually and collectively towards that end and not waiting for some super organization to form. It already did, and we're all standing in it. It's called the human race, and we need to recognize that each thing that each of us do is important, and none are big or small or great or little. They're just all important. And I would say this strongly, is to make change in the world today, and people always ask, you know, what are the solutions? And these are the solutions, is we have to recognize our individual potentials and begin acting as human beings on those potentials. And that doesn't mean going to the point where we're all stressed out and flipped out about what we can't get done, because then you've gone too far. Do what you can do with confidence and absolute knowledge of being able to accomplish. Do just that on the things that you care about and that are of interest to you, and things will change. That's all that's required, is constant, earnest effort within the capabilities that we each have. And our spheres of influence might only be our neighbors and our families, or it might be something bigger than that. Maybe we're on a radio program as a host or a guest today having a conversation with a wider audience. But each of these things is incredibly important. Who you as a listener talk to today about the issues that are important to you today, you have no idea where that energy goes. And I'll tell you, the things that took us into the European Parliament, that got this issue in front of the public in Europe and many parts of the country started with somebody saying, you know, that's an interesting topic. Maybe I can help. And I had a guy from a mail room working in Munich, Germany, contact me and ask, how can he help? And by the end of a couple of years of effort, triggered by just an inquiry, we were in front of the European Parliament. And I can trace the chain of events all the way back to that conversation. So was it the work I did, or was it the work of that mailroom clerk?
Right.
And I would say the mailroom clerk wins.
and
we're all the mailroom clerks, folks, whether we know it or not. We all have a chance to make a difference in the world around us by acting on what we know to be right and true and within the realm of our own capability, and then things change.
Yeah,
and that is the only way they'll change.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I want to, every time I get to review your material, I find more new things in it. And if you want to go ahead and give us the information on how to contact you, and I really want to thank you very much for coming on the program, you and Dr. Carlstrom, and you know, discussing this, all these different subjects, because they're all very interesting.
Well, thank you for having me. And people can contact me at earthpulse.com, earthpulse.com, and that's our website. A lot of free information there, a lot of articles and materials, and of course, pick up one of our books or videos. That's how we stay in this work. And when you're done with it, pass it on to your congressman. Maybe they'll read it or hear it too.
And I hope Dr. Carlstrom's still there. I don't know if – I can't tell whether he got –
Yeah, I'm here. I've just been enjoying the conversation and listening. If anybody's interested in following up on my website's www.naturalclimatechange.us, and www.911nwo.com. That's, of course, New World Order. But I also find many, many avenues of thought-provoking ideas here with our interview with Nick Begich, and I sure appreciate being able to talk to you, Nick, and joining us, and look forward to getting some of your DVDs and learning more about some of these topics that you've been researching.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me, and my best to everyone in the new year.
Well, thanks again.
Okay, Happy New Year. Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.